the question was asked based on what it says in the Rambam and in other sources that the Torah is the best way to live in this world, irrespective of the world to come. How should one understand that? And there are a few aspects to this, but I want us to focus only on one. Okay? I reserve the right on a different occasion to discuss other aspects, but for tonight, let's focus on one. Some kids get hyper when they eat too many sweets. Some kids, it's enough to eat a pack of Winkies and they're already jumping jelly beans. So on Shabbos afternoon, many children here in Israel go to say Tehillim. And at the end of the Tehillim, they get mamtak, they get a sweet. So we're standing outside the shul, and the children are all rummaging around. Everyone has their sweets. And this one kid is all hyper. You know, can't sit still. And tells Abba, but she gave me her sweet, and I want to eat it. And his father says, you can't stand still without it. You're not going to take another sweet and eat that too. And the kid is wailing, and he's all upset. Okay. The couple is standing at the entrance to the restaurant, and the husband tells her, look, honey, we came here to celebrate our 50th anniversary. I want to celebrate our 60th anniversary together, too. The doctor says, we have to watch your cholesterol. Do me a favor. Let's not overeat tonight. Let's be careful what we take. Let's do what we can to make it to our 60th anniversary tonight. And she looks at him mortified. And she's seething. And he says, don't you understand? It's because I cherish you and I cherish our relationship and I want you with me as long as possible. What do the two stories have in common? What's the difference between the father and the child? The child wants the pleasure of now. The father wants what's good for the child long term. The husband wants something that'll be good for both of them long term. The wife is insulted by the way he said it, upset that she can't have it the way she wants it, however you'll interpret her reaction. But at the end of the day, the husband is trying to focus long term. Rav Sadia Gaon, in his introduction to Sefer Mishlei, says, the Jewish way of life can be summarized, the book of Mishlei can be summarized with this, that Torah repeatedly trains us for the long-term pleasure, which is far more worthwhile than the short-term pleasures. The human being has a choice in life. A person can say, I'm going to work all the days of my life, and I'm going to make a lot of money, and I'm going to run around and do everything I want to do. Or a person can say, I take the 6th day in the afternoon and I go home and I get ready. And even if I didn't make as much money as I would have liked, I shut my computer, I detach myself from the world, and I'm going to spend time with my family. And I'm going to go Friday night and be with my community. And I'm going to come home and have a fantastic meal with my family. And whether I made more money or less money, on this one day I'm a king. There are many ways in which the Torah teaches us to master our lives. The world, the way it plays itself out, can be a dog-eat-dog world. But then what happens is you become a dog. You spend your life chasing after living, chasing after outdoing the other one, chasing after an attempt to prove that you're great. Look at my Mercedes, look at my Rolls Royce. Look at my paycheck. Look at how big I am. Look at how smart I am. Look at how cool I am. Look at me. There is an inner drive for a person to achieve a certain level of satisfaction. And the question is, where do you achieve that satisfaction? And most people spend their life searching and not finding it. And it's true that there are the short thrills, and if you don't lead a life of Torah, so then there's no reason a person should get married. Why should I be bound to one woman? There are a million out there. Why should I be bound to supporting her? I could go to a bar every night and do what I want. What do I need to support her for? The Torah trains us to make long-term investments and reap their rewards. The Torah also gives us the capacity to truly enjoy the good of this world. You know, a guy walks into he walks into the king's palace, and the king wants to see what he'll do with his time there. So the king sets up a few sweets for him to take without permission on the right, and he sets up a brothel on the left, and he sets up a pool hall way ahead, and he sets up a whole bunch of different things to seduce the guy from his real purpose. Now the guy could spend his whole lifetime in the castle doing that. There's another guy who walks in, and he walks over to the king, and he asks how he's doing, and he builds a relationship with the king. He builds a relationship which will give him everything he saw and more, things that by far exceed what he's seen in the castle. The castle is this world. There are all kinds of attractions all around to distract us. And at first glance, those attractions seem very appealing. So you'll tell me a guy led a life of Torah and he made much less money than his competition. And I'll say, right. I never said that leading a life of Torah will make you monetarily rich. I said leading a life of Torah is going to be rewarding. It will make you rich on much deeper levels. If my gauge for happiness is how much money do I have in the bank, then I cannot guarantee you that the Torah lifestyle is what's going to make you rich. If my gauge for happiness is how many times did I go out to the ball game, how many hamburgers did I eat, well, if that's the gauge of happiness, then you're right. Then I don't think Torah will give it to you. But if the gauge of happiness is what we call happiness, it's satisfaction, it's leading a worthwhile life, it's reaping the real benefits of long-term investments, it's sitting at a Shabbos table and seeing your children and having nachas from them. You know, well, how do you say nachas in English? There's no word for it. You ever wonder why? Think about it. People sometimes ask me to translate the word of nachas, and you use a whole bunch of words, but you never get it. What?
Pride often,
no? Yeah, nachas is pride, pleasure. Think about it. I don't think it encompasses the word. So I think that the more you see, the more you'll see that the Torah teaches us to make the long-term investment and reap the long-term benefits. It's true that we forgo certain short-term pleasures. It's true that there are things that would be fun to do and things that might be short-term rewarding, and could be. Guy has $1 million in the bank. Okay, there's a lot he could do with it. But who said he has a happier life? When we say the Torah gives us the formula for a happy life in this world, we're talking about worthwhile long-term benefits, and we're talking about leading a life where a person enjoys and enjoys on an elementary level, but has the joy that comes, the deeper joy that comes with long-term investment.
I understand that completely, and I cannot argue that at all. But that still doesn't explain why Rabbi Elazar, there's a hobby that maybe he was crying because this world wasn't good. So fine, even if she's physical, pleasure, he didn't want that. He wants spiritual pleasure. So if he's a benefit, it doesn't matter which one, he shouldn't be crying.
That's a different question. Okay? So that's a different question. If that's what you meant, so that's a different question.
We understand that there's a higher level of pleasure, and that's why we seek it. And that's not why we seek it, but that is definitely the reason to seek it. But
I have a pshat which I always understood in this Gemara, but I don't remember if I ever saw it in sight. I want to look. There's a pshat that seems obvious to me. That's what the Gemara meant when it said it. But I want to see if someone spells it out before I say it. So that's a different question. If you're asking on this Gemara, why was that one of the options that Rabbi Yochanan was saying? So that I want to look into.
In general, I think there's many instances where people reach the end of their life and they are asking. I don't know if there is. Are there people that reach the end of their life and they lived Judaism completely, they suffered immensely, and they maybe didn't feel the satisfaction and pleasure that the other guy gets? get. But not even they didn't feel, I know the different pleasures that they're getting, the nachas from other people, their nachas from other people didn't equal that, the pleasure this guy was getting from going to the brothel and the pool hall and the candy shop.
You think so?
I'm asking you, is that possible?
I don't think so. I think for many reasons not. On a simple level, pleasure and happiness are not synonymous. It's two different things. So it could be that the guy who does whatever he wants has more pleasure, but I don't think he has more happiness. Happiness is a byproduct of a productive life. Pleasure can be very, very short-term, very short-lived. There are two types of people who walk into a restaurant. There's a person who's saved up, and he can afford it. And after preparing and having a special occasion, he goes out with his family or whatever it is, and he spends the money. Then you have a guy who felt like having a steak for supper. He could afford it, he couldn't afford it, whichever way you want to go. He walks in and has the same supper. They both eat the same exact meal. What would you say? They both had the same pleasure. Did they both have the same happiness? Did they both have the same simcha? I don't think so. Okay? I think that the Torah is just a whole lifestyle which is about simcha. The Torah is about true joy. It's about simcha. But true joy means joy from simple things. What do we eat on Shabbos? We eat cholent. Why do we eat cholent? Because cholent was the cheapest food in Europe. People couldn't afford anything. So they took the cheapest bean, they took the cheap potato, they mixed them together, and they made it a special food. Cholent. They didn't have meat in their cholent. They'd slaughter one animal for the whole town, and if that animal wasn't kosher, so that's it, no meat this Shabbos.
My mom makes a great cholent.
So, our happiness did not revolve around the external physical. We knew how to use it. You know, we do use it as a tool. We do eat. We're not sitting at the Shabbos table starving together. But it's a tool. It's part of a bigger picture.
But if you see a person who's suffering from sorrow, right, and he lives Judaism completely, halakhically and spiritually, is it possible that he is not getting that satisfaction from Judaism that it has to offer? Because he's crying, he's been afflicted. So how can we say it? I mean, you can say it, but is it really true? Is it really true to say, oh, you're really living a much, much better life than this person who's succumbed?
What's the alternative? I'm not following. You're saying, give an example. Meaning, this guy closes his shop on Shabbos, he loses his position every Shabbos.
His wife passes away, he passes away, he has kids, everything is pretty bad.
That's Rabbi Yochanan, right? But what would have been different had he not kept the Torah mitzvahs? Rabbi Yochanan lost his whole family. Eov lost his whole family. What would he have gained had he lived a different lifestyle? His wife wouldn't have died. What would have been different?
You're saying one thing. You can't say that there are many people during history and during the course of history, if not millions of people, that had sarot because they wanted to be Jewish and they were persecuted by Jewish and by non-Jews because they wanted to be Jewish. So yeah, same thing. People that they were born in goyim, but they fought for everything in order to accept Torah. Why? You know what I mean? I'm giving you the example. Yeah.
He's not saying you should keep Torah for the sake of the simcha.
There are some people that because we have Torah, because we have so many commandments, that sometimes we could be more happy in a certain way, but maybe the commandments, we need to be in a certain way, maybe we're preventing ourselves to be happy. Because we have so many commandments, we can be free to do whatever we want. But there are many people, they do the same thing in order to accept to have, instead of having just seven commandments, to have 630.
I'm not doubting that Torah makes people live a very, very good life. but there are those that it seems like are not enjoying a very good life. You look at us, it seems, I mean, pretty obvious to all of us, right? We're not even eating our children. And it's clear to us that Rami and I said, well, when you look at people like, they go through sorrow, then do you think they would tell you if you would ask them? Do you think they would tell you I'm happy and having a good, meaningful life? They would say, probably, well, I can't wait to the next world. You know, hopefully it's going to be a lot better than this.
Okay, so 2 points. I think there are definitely people who are suffering. Go to a Jew who's standing outside the gas chambers in Auschwitz and tell him you have a much better life because you led a Jewish life. So, let me quote you a Gemara in Tanis. And you could ask on this, but think about it.
Do we have a Tanis here?
Okay. The Gemara in the end of the second chapter tells us the story of two brothers, Pappus and Lulianus, from the city of Lutkia, otherwise known as Lut. And the king or the governor's daughter was found murdered. So of course they assumed it was the Jews. So the Romans were ready to annihilate the town. Along came Pappus and Lulianus, and they said, I think the Roman governor, his name was Nicanor, if I'm not mistaken. They came to him and they said, we killed her. So he brought them before the executioner. And he said, do you think God's going to save you like he saved Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah? You guys think you're righteous. You didn't do it. So is God really going to save you? So they said, no, he's not. Because Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they were righteous, and we're not. And the king judged them with a fair legal system. You know, there was a system there. And here there isn't. The one who's judging us is not fair, and there is no system. So we don't merit, nor does our judge merit to see such a miracle. And anyways, we deserve to be killed. We know we're going to die. And the truth is that God could have killed us with lions or bears. There are many other ways God could have killed us. But he chose to have us die at your hands so that you will be punished over our deaths. They were executed, meaning in spite of what they just told him, he killed them. And right afterwards he was killed by the Romans. The Romans sent messengers to have him executed. Right after he killed them. And sometimes we have to remember that perspective. This enters a different angle, which I didn't want to touch on tonight. You're assuming that if someone would lead a different life, then his life would look different. And I'm assuming not. I think that sometimes that assumption is challenged. Sometimes a person sees, like during the period of the Great Depression, where all the Jews who kept Shabbos kept losing their jobs. If they didn't show up on Shabbos, then on Sunday they got a pink slip. They were told, we don't want you again. And in those days, that was really hard. They had families to feed, and they had a question, are they keeping Shabbos, or are they feeding their families? And the people who kept Shabbos, why? I don't know how you look those people in the eyes. Those are angels. I mean, the challenge of not knowing what you're going to feed your families, and standing up to that challenge, and not showing up to work on Shabbos, what can I say? What did those people get? Again, so you'll quote stories this way, and I'll quote stories that way. I think that in the big picture, over time, as you see more, I think the facts will speak for themselves. I could tell you that Rav Moshe Feinstein, he was rabbi in Russia, and the Russians, you know, they have a very long constitution, and they had a very long constitution in order to ensure everyone's rights. Maybe the longest constitution in the world. So, of course, they weren't about to infringe on anyone's rights, but the government happened to need his home. So they confiscated his home. So he doesn't have a home. So he's out in the street with his wife and his eldest son, his son and daughter. And they, someone from the congregation took a part of his house, and he said, Rabbi, we're putting a mechitza. He had one room, he had a one-room house. He said, we're putting a mechitza here. This side of the mechitza is yours. This side of the mechitza is mine. Come live with me. And that's how he lived. The Russians, again, were big into freedom of religion, as is well known. So they had no reason to go against the Jews specifically, but They just needed the Jewish mikveh, so they confiscated the Jewish mikveh because they needed it for the government purposes, so no mikveh. So Rav Moshe Feinstein got in cahoots with someone who was in charge of the public swimming pool, and they figured out a way to make the public swimming pool into a kosher mikveh. So that the women who wanted to, they had women's hours, men's hours. Once upon a time, the world was a modest place. So even the non-Jews didn't think that women go bathing with men. So they would be able to go and find a way of loosening their bathing suit and whatever, they'd have kosher mikveh. But he didn't want to rely on that. He didn't, you know, he held better than nothing. At least they'll have something. So the women in town will have some kind of mikveh to go to. But he didn't rely on it. So there's an 11-year gap between his second daughter, Aleha Shalom, and his third son. You understand what that means? 11 years, the couple's married, but he holds that she's a Nida, so they're not touching for 11 years. What? Let's fast forward. What Moshe Feinstein used to say. What? I don't know whether he paskened it for others. He did his best to ensure that there was something that the congregation could rely on, because most people, if you tell them to stay apart for 11 years, it's not so clear they're going to stand up to that test. So he figured out a way of doing something that they'd be able to rely on. But obviously he held that a person on a more pious level should not rely on it. He used to say that common sense would dictate that anyone who just looks at the two lifestyles would adopt the Jewish lifestyle. You have to ask yourself why people don't. He said, common sense dictates. You just look at the two lifestyles. Isn't it obvious to people? That's a line that he used to say frequently. Now you'll tell me, what do you mean? 11 years? We don't believe in saints. In Judaism, we say everyone's human, everyone's normal. Everyone has their desires, and a person has to be married and build a family, and that's normalcy. We don't believe that people should try to be celibate. No, we believe in a normal marital life. And yet, this was his description. So maybe I'll share with you another story. I don't remember the names, unfortunately. Someone came to one of the rebbes and said to him, how do I contend with the difficulties in my life with a smile on my face? And the Rebbe sent him to one of the Hasidim that was known that he was ill and he lost children, and every type of tzara under the sun had befallen that Hasid. And that Hasid was known that he had probably the most miserable life anyone ever heard of. So they come knocking at his door, and they're not sure exactly how to word the question. And this, I think it was a pair of Hasidim. They came to this other Hasid, and they knock on his door, and he opens the door with a big warm smile, and he asks, how can I help you? And they say, well, the Rebbe sent us to you. The Rebbe sent you? No, it can't be sent you to me. I think you got the wrong house. They say, no, you're Rebbe so-and-so, yeah. Can't be. What would the Rebbe, how could I do anything? So they said, no. The Rebbe told us to talk to you. So he says, fine. The Rebbe said, come on in. What can I get you to drink? He brings him something. He says, sits down with him. The Rebbe said, we should ask you how a person can contend with hardships in life with a smile. So he bursts out laughing. He says, I told you got the wrong house. And he ushered them out. And I'll tell you the final story of the Kleisenberger Rebbe in the camps. And his speech, I think it was Yom Kippur. No one thought they would make it out alive. And it's a pity I don't have the exact text in front of me, but his words went along the lines, along these lines. He said, when we prepare for our Yom Kippur davening, I'm not going to talk about the moments when we desired that we would already be the smoke coming out of the chimney. We all know we have to do tshuva for that. I'm not going to talk about the moments when we wanted to throw ourselves at the electric fences, because we all know we need to do tshuva for that. And he went on and on, describing what he would not talk about. And then he said, the only thing I want to talk about is those mornings when we woke up to the service of our Creator and did not put a smile on our faces and feel excited that we merit to be servants in the army of Hashem. It's about those mornings that I want to remind you that you also have to do tshuva, because the other stuff we all know. But we all had those mornings when we woke up and we did not feel rejoicing, we did not feel glad at our lot that we merit to be the servants of Hashem. I think, if I remember correctly, it was the Kloisenberger Rebbe. Yeah. He lost his whole family, 11 children in the Holocaust, lost everyone. Came to Israel with no one. But when he came to Israel, his focus was on building and helping others. And there are many such stories. I think that it is one of the challenges in life. It's a question of perspective, but I think it's a true perspective. I don't think it's a question of fooling oneself. This goes back to what Bezalel told you. And if I said it to you, so then, you know, I'm talking from within. Bezalel had a choice. He didn't have to do 613 mitzvot. And you're hearing it from a man who says, I'm telling you, I lived the free life, and I'm telling you that you're not free when you're out there. You're a slave to your desires, you're a slave to the whims of society, you're a slave to the styles of society. You're not free. It's always a question of what will others say and how can I outdo the next guy. And Bezalel said it, not I. I don't like saying those things, but he has a right to say those things. So he said it. And I think these are things which the more you'll see the balance of Jewish life, the more you'll appreciate them. If you're curious, I could send you what Binyamin Zwicker sent me. There was a research poll, a scientific research poll on happiness in the United States. I think it was Gallup that interviewed over 250,000 people to see which religions give people the most satisfaction. But I don't believe in statistics. Meaning, if that interests you, it happens to be that Judaism was on top. But that I don't think that proves anything. If you feel it proves something, so I could share, I could send you that link. Okay?